Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for joining me and listening wherever you may be around the world. And today I'm doing a solo podcast episode rehashing one of my favorite trilogies of all time. That is the Acacia Trilogy, written by David Anthony Durham. A series that, up until this very day, is still not very well known in the science fiction and fantasy community, for reasons beyond my comprehension. I just don't know why, but maybe I'm here to rectify that a little bit. So, before we dive into the details of what this book is, and what it entails, and how it has stolen my heart over the past 12 years since I first read it, let me go back to 2009. So, 2009, that's when the first season of Game of Thrones, the TV show, came out on HBO. I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't much of a reader back then. This is when I was still in college. So my brother came up to me and said, Blaze, you need to watch the first season of Game of Thrones, which I did, fell in love with it, and proceeded to read the rest of the series up until that point. So that was 2011, was when the last book, A Dance with Dragons, was published. And right now, in 2023, we're still waiting for the next installment of A Song of Ice and Fire, but I digress. That's a conversation for another podcast episode. So, I needed to fill the void in my heart, and the way to do that was to find other series out there, similar in style and feel, I thought, to A Song of Ice and Fire. And I came across The Acacia Trilogy by David Anthony Durham. And ironically, George R. R. Martin gives a blurb on the front cover saying, David Anthony Durham has serious chops. I can't wait to read whatever he writes next. So immediately that grabbed my attention and I thought, okay, let me dive in and see what this series is all about. So from the back cover, if you read it, and I'll read it right now for you, it says, welcome to Acacia. Born into generations of prosperity, the four royal children of the Acheron dynasty know little of the world outside their opulent island paradise. But when an assassin strikes at the heart of their power, their lives are changed forever. Forced to flee to distant corners and separated against their will, the children must navigate a web of hidden allegiances, ancient magic, foreign invaders, and illicit trade that will challenge their very notion of who they are. As they come to understand their true purpose in life, the fate of the world lies in their hands. So, you can immediately see the connection between A Song of Ice and Fire and this trilogy. It's four royal children, and they're separated by, let's call it, a tragic event. And just so you guys know, I'm not going to be going into any spoilers more than what you see on the back cover. I'm just going to give you details surrounding what is said, and to enlighten everything and to maybe push you over the edge and maybe pick up this series. So don't worry on that front about any spoilers, so to speak. Now, please forgive me from the get-go because there's a lot of ground I want to cover on this, and it may seem like I'm disjointed and going from one thing to the other very quickly, but I promise I'll make it as coherent as possible. So why would anyone pick up this trilogy apart from the Song of Ice and Fire hook? Well, there's several reasons. The first is, David Anthony Durham writes amazing characters. You fall in love with them. You want to cheer for them. In some cases, you want to hate them. The full spectrum is on full display in this trilogy. So if you're a reader who invests in characters and that's your primary driving force, this series is for you. Another reason is the overall world building in here. It's unlike anything I've read. And I know I say that a lot, but this is true. It's a kingdom ruled by the elite, but there's other factions of the kingdom that you get in touch with. You get in touch with the merchants, to the priests, to the fishermen, to everyone involved in the kingdom and how that works. So that's another aspect that will make readers love this series. Also, there's a clear, quote-unquote, enemy that is, it's not necessarily a series of good versus evil. There's different shades of gray encompassing this series. But you understand the enemy and what their main purpose is, and you get that full side of the story. And finally, the reason you want to pick up this series is because of the prose. Now, I'm not one who needs prose to be like the nth degree flowery and beautiful written in order to enjoy a story. I'm more of a character person myself and plot, but the prose definitely add a layer to this story, and they make everything that much more beautiful and enjoyable. Now, a little later in this episode, I'm going to be reading a section of book one to you just so you can enjoy David's writing and also give a more insight into what's actually going on. But first, I want to talk about the four children in particular. There's four of them. There's two boys, two girls, led by the father. Each one is different in their own special ways, and I'll bring those to light here in my discussion. So, first one is the eldest son named Aliver. That's Aliver, A-L-I-V-E-R. He is kind of like Captain of the Guards, very royal, very combat ready. He's a great fighter. He's a great thinker. He's like a general on the field, the one set to inherit the throne. And he's the one who keeps everyone calm and knows about how everything's supposed to operate. The second oldest child, the oldest daughter named Corin. Now, Corin is very regal. She's very political. She's very manipulative, and she knows what needs to be done. She sees the inner workings of the kingdom and of the secret trades and everything that needs to go on. So she has the mind to rule, and she has the mind of someone you want by your side. She doesn't always make the right choices, but she definitely knows how to work the room, so to speak. The third child, the second son, name is Dariel. Now, Dariel's a bit of a wild card. He likes to go on adventures. He likes to see what's going on. He wants to uncover different parts about the kingdom, so to speak. And that gets on full display later in the story. And the fourth child, the youngest one, is called Mina. Now, Mina, at first, you don't see much from her. But in the second half of the story, you see just how much of an amazing character she is. She's like a pistol. She's shoots from the hip. She knows who she cares about, and she'll do anything to protect them, but she'll do that in her own special way. So those are the four children. Now, let's get into the main plot and the enemy. The world of Acacia is called the Known World, and Acacia is essentially a small island on the eastern part of the continent. And on the main continent, it's surrounded by it's very long up and down. Like, you have the cold of the north, you have the deserts of the south, and you have traders any which way. So they live on their small island, right? To the north is this foreign, we'll call them a tribe, called the Mien. Now, the Mien are not known to this world. They come from a different continent, but that's getting too much into the quote-unquote spoiler territory. That is for another discussion. The Mien are kind of a warrior tribe, and they're inhabiting the cold and bitter north. Now, this tribe is quote-unquote cursed in that they cannot bear children of their own. The reasons for that will be discussed later in the series, and I will not spoil that for you. You need to get there on your own. But just know that they are quote-unquote like a dying tribe, but they still have access to their ancestors' souls or spirits, and they communicate with them. They know in the capital of Acacia that there is a hidden book. This book contains the magical workings of the long-lost mages called the Santoth. The Santoth existed many centuries before, and they were a team of very powerful mages. And they have been lost ever since this great event. Again, not getting into spoilers for that. But all their workings are condensed into this one book. And through political maneuvering and secret spies, the Mien have found it. And they also know that this book can help them bring back their ancestors in some way or fashion. And in order to do that, they need to infiltrate the capital and basically take over. So that's the kind of starting point that we need to understand before going into this series. Now, the event that you heard when I read the back cover, assassination attempt, throws the whole continent into chaos, and the children are forced to disperse. They disperse because each of them has a quote-unquote known guardian. Now, the guardians, they don't know who they are, but they know that they're supposed to find them and to go wherever they need to go. And here's a spicy little twist for you. The only one who truly finds their guardian and leads them to the correct place is Oliver. I know I said I wasn't going to talk about spoilers, but that's just a little bit of a hook to get you into it. I promise I won't go any further than that. Now, that is the plot and those are the characters, but there's more background in this world that I want to go over. Riddled around the continent of the known world, the common people and even the royals and people who have status are addicted to this drug. This drug is called the Mist. Now, the Mist is not made on the known world. It is made in the other lands, which is a continent across the sea, and it is dispersed to the people in order to put forth a sense of control. They're addicted to it. It makes them very loopy. It makes them very not engaged and not knowing the true horror that's going around the land. The trade-off for this Mist drug is that there is a slave quota. Every year, there's a certain number of children that are taken to the other lands in exchange for this Mist drug. They are taken by this entity called the League. The League controls basically all the sea trades, and they're immensely powerful in terms of political maneuvering. The head of the League negotiates with the other lands and the known world, like certain deals, and they hold immense influence over events to happen in this book. Won't go any further than that, but the League is one of the more fascinating entities you'll find in any fantasy novel and or series. So that is basically everything going on in terms of plot, characters, and lore that we're going to go into. Now, I mentioned prose. So I'm going to read a section of this book to just highlight David Anthony Durham's prose and how you'll instantly fall in love with it. And this is not going into any quote-unquote spoilers. This is just the beginning to chapter 6. So, late in the evening, Leodin Acheron heard someone enter his private chamber. He did not look up, but he knew who it was. The chancellor's slipped footfalls had a unique rhythm to them, something that the king had once pinpointed as stiffness in the right leg. A servant had just lit his mist pipe and withdrawn. The pungent scent of the drug was, at the moment, the only thing that mattered. A phantom had clung to the back of his head throughout the day, a hunger he envisioned as a bat-like creature that huddled around the contours of his skull, its claws sharp and thin as curved needles where they pierced his flesh and found purchase by anchoring into the bone. It had gripped him during his morning meetings, left him for a time during an hour spent with Corin, but returned with sharpened, malicious claws throughout the evening. It prodded him as he dined and gnawed at him as he put Dariel down to sleep. When Dariel had asked him for a story, Leodin had grimaced. It was just for a moment. The boy had not even seen it, but it remained a nagging shame that he couldn't long for his own vices while still in the company of his children. Where would he be without his children? Without Mena, who still, precious months more perhaps, wanted him to spin tales for her. And Dariel, who hung on his words with a trusting certainty, the father knew time would shatter. Shame on him for letting a moment with them pass in distraction. He told Dariel the story he asked for, and then he stood a few extra moments beside the boy's door, listening to his slumbering breath. All this was earlier. His feeble penance was completed. Now the pipe sat on the low table before him. It was an intrinsic confusion of glass tubes and water-filled chambers and leather hoses, one of which the king held between the fingertips of both hands. He placed the narrow bit of it between his teeth, touching it with his tongue. He inhaled gently at first, then as he tasted the bitter, putrid sweetness of the mist, his cheeks caved against his jawbones. The pipe bubbled and sputtered. He stayed huddled forward, eyes closed, aware that his chancellor stood near him but not caring. This was nothing Thaddeus had not seen before. When he fell back against the cushions of his couch, he exhaled a slow plume of green vapor. The creature on his head plucked out its talons one by one. It faded into nothingness. The opiate numbed the edges of the world. He felt no barbs. Instead, he was filled with the blurred tranquility, a warm feeling of connection with the millions of people throughout his empire tied to the same drug. Peasant, farmers, and blacksmiths, municipal guards and rubbish collectors, miners, slavers, in this one thing he was the same as them all. It was, to the reasoning of his muted mind, a secret offering made for their forgiveness. He opened his eyes, clouded now in veined reddish-brown. What news has the Chancellor to share? Now, the book is split into three parts, and there's also going to be a time jump between one or two of those parts, when like the children are in their own parts of the world, growing older, gaining more experience, and then you can probably guess what's going to happen. They will eventually converge, and then the story will go from there. This is a story that just captured my heart. The first book in and of itself can be read as just one completed standalone book, because the sequels take place several years later, and it will bring back the joy that you had when you first read A Game of Thrones. And if you haven't read Game of Thrones, I suggest you do that as soon as possible. Say what you want about George Martin, and we all are in pain and we all are angry with him for not getting out the books as soon as possible. But at the same time, it's still a series that stands on a pedestal in any of the lists or any of the surveys you have about the top fantasy epics of all time. This is a completed trilogy and will also capture your heart and imagination. It really is an underrated gem that needs a larger audience. And I hope that this will give you the inspiration to maybe pick this up. I will try to the nth degree to find and hopefully get on the author, David Anthony Durham, to my podcast. This will be one of the best stories that you will read, and I promise you that I've not read anything else like it. It's original, it's creative, it makes you think, and the books progress where each book makes you question things you read in the previous one, and especially the final volume. There's a huge revelation that brings everything you've read into books one and two flat on its head, and I can't wait for you all to read it. Please reach out to me if you have any questions, and I look forward to getting your feedback on this. But until then, cheers, everybody, and thanks for listening.